this good sound line or is it too loud?
It's good.
Okay. I was trying to remember today when exactly I caught wind of this book. And I'm not sure, but it was ahead of the publication date. I'd seen this image online. And I don't know about you all, but I really dug the cover. And I know Emily Smith at Lookout Books a little bit, so I emailed her and asked if there were any advanced copies left, and I may have been snagged the last one. I mean, there were not that many left, so I got it. And the stories that I found inside more than validated the feeling that I had on seeing the cover. And the book, as you can read, has garnered much deserved praise, including a development so recent that I don't think it's even noted in that bio we have there, and that is that we show what we have learned was named a finalist for the Young Lions Fiction Award from the New York Public Library. Let me say this, and then I'll set aside. Students in my special topics course this semester, many of which are here right now, they had a chance to read the book, and our discussions of both its timeliness and timelessness were never more important than on Tuesday, February 7th. That day, at high noon, in yet another of the oncoming absurd developments in our nation's present, Betsy DeVos had been confirmed as Education Secretary. At 1 p.m. that day, my class gathered in Woodburn Hall, just across the street, to educate ourselves, to unlearn and relearn, to come apart and together by discussing, among other things, the title story from the collection. How fitting a short story it was for the historical moment we all shared, how devastatingly hopeful and dire at the same time. Just as the rest of these tales, their poetic lines true, their interpretations always blooming in ways somehow literal and magical both. In one story, titled Ailments, the narrator and her sister have just listened to their mother read aloud from scripture, the story of Jacob and Rachel. Well, the young narrator asks, the moral mother, and she suspects that some unnameable thing will be illuminated. She thinks, now our mother would have to give it words. And then we read the following. Our mother fixed us with a level gaze. Sometimes, she said, a story is only a story. Ain't it the truth? And a lie, too, I think. A story may only be a story, but a story is all there is. Please join me in giving a warm Morgantown welcome to Claire Deans.
Thank you so much, Glenn. That was wonderful. And thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for having me here. So I thought I would just read, actually, the title story of the collection, which is not that long a reading, so there will be plenty of time if you guys have questions or if I can talk about anything that might interest you after. Okay. We show what we have learned. Before her disintegration, we had long held an absolute and unwavering contempt for Miss Swenson. She had won that with her uncertainty, which we had sensed in the very first moments of our very first day of fifth grade, the way dogs can smell fear. Waves of it rolled off her, along with the odor of cats and Kleenex and chalk that hung unsurprisingly in her sad, pilly sweaters. Miss Swenson was pitiful, but this did not mean we pitied her. We felt nothing for the faded blue of her eyes, which were like a sea creature's soft underbelly, or for the way she kept them open so wide and blinked so rapidly that she seemed to be seeing us through a mist. Her movements, too, were misty, whereas we were sharp and quick and feral. We did not wonder much about her life. She seemed ageless to us in the way that most adults seemed ageless. We could not have said whether she was 25 or 40, but we did know that she was younger than most of the other teachers. This was less because her face was unlined and because she seemed so much more unfinished. Everything Miss Swenson ever said to us had a question in it. Even when she explained long division or poetry, things it was clear she understood and loved, and even when she told Mark Peters to stop it when he pulled down Sally Winter's pants and underpants to show us the hair-flecked space between her legs. The question in her voice then was simply more panicked than usual. The day the disintegration began, we were learning about Native American civilization. We were always learning about Native American civilization. We began each year with it, and then we might, as on that day, when we were supposed to be talking about the Civil War, make several unexpected detours back to revel in the quietude of that life so close to nature. The teachers all loved these lost things, vanished ways of life, great men who died early, extinct animals, and Miss Swenson loved them even more than most. We watched while she drew a wigwam on the board. Miss Swenson was very bad at drawing, worse even than the worst of us, because she was crippled by second-guessing. She darted in to draw a line, darted back to look at it, darted back in to erase it and start over. "Is that straight?" she asked us, "but wasn't it supposed to be rounded? Wasn't that the whole point?" Finally, she sighed in a way that meant she was giving up and settling for the misshapen thing she had produced. "You see, children, the hole was put there," she said, pointing, "so that the cooking smells could escape. It's ingenious." Her hands began to wave desperately and hopelessly, as if she were trying to breathe with them, like vestigial gills. There was something beautiful about her excitement in these moments, irresistible target though it was. The early colonists were never so ingenious. In many ways, the civilization they would brutally overpower was vastly superior to their own. Abner Harris raised his hand. Miss Swenson never did learn not to call on him. Perhaps she was distracted by the glimmering vision of wigwams in her mind, a whole village of them where she might have lived gently and happily in our absence, tending plants, fetching water from the stream, watching smoke rise toward bright stars. "Yes, Abner," Miss Swenson said. "Is that what holes are always there for?" "Is what they're always there for, Abner?" "So smells can escape? Is that what, like, Rachel's hole is there for?" "Rachel's hole?" Miss Swenson said, musingly, still failing to understand, though Rachel was already blushing. When Miss Swenson got there, two red spots appeared high on her cheeks. "Abner, that is inappropriate," she said, and yet managed to sound as if she were asking for permission to reprimand him. "What is?" Mock innocence was mortally wounding to her. She couldn't help taking it at face value. We waded, snuffling into our hands and tasting the salt of our palms, chewing on the skin around our fingernails with the glee of what was coming. "To speak about the," she flopped like a speared fish, "private parts of others." "But Miss Swenson," said Billy Nichols, drawn to the blood in the water, "which parts are private? I forget." We squeaked our sweaty hands against our desks in joy. Now she would have to say them, say those words. What could be more wonderful? We would hear them from her lips. And that was when it happened. We would wonder ever after what caused it, the force of the bottled up, forbidden words we were calling forth, or the hammering blows of the humiliation we were delivering, whether the force came from within or without. Miss Swenson, in her agitation, flicked her webby hair behind her ear, chalk still in hand, and in the process flicked some object off herself. It flew forth with so much force that the act would have seemed intentional but for the puzzlement on her face. An earring, we assumed at first, but the earrings Miss Swenson wore were not as large as this. Hannah Perkins in the first row began to scream. She was peering over the edge of her desk at the thing on the floor, and she curled her feet up under her as if to keep them away from a mouse. We left our seats and clustered around the space in front of Hannah's desk. The thing on the ground was an earlobe. Detached, it looked very fleshy, though Miss Swenson had never before seemed to have especially fleshy ears. It sat on the ground like a fat, self-satisfied grub, one that had perhaps eaten its brethren. Miss Swenson's small gold hoop earring was still in place, puckering the roundest part of the lobe's belly. There was no blood, there was simply one ragged edge. Naturally, we looked from there to the rest of Miss Swenson's still attached ear, the matching puzzle piece, the yin to the lobe's yang. No blood there either. The gap made us queasy, but it seemed more the result of a shedding than of a wound. Then we looked at her face. Miss Swenson said. She turned away. We thought she might begin to scream. Instead, she went calmly to her desk, swished the tissue from its box, and returned to the lobe on the carpet. She covered it with the tissue, and for a second it seemed she might leave it there, a small sheet over a small corpse. Then, with an expression of distaste, she reached out and lifted it, just as she might have lifted a dog turd. She walked back to her desk, opened the drawer, and placed the lobe inside. She shut the drawer softly. Only then did she look at us. She seemed to have just remembered where she was. "I can trust you, I think," she said, "not to mention this to anyone." We were surprised by the lack of a question in her voice. Our classroom was quieter than it had ever been. If she planned for this to stay a secret somehow, we would not keep her away. We nodded, 26 heads in unison, the first grown-up promise we had ever made, one of the few some of us would ever keep. "Now," said Miss Swenson, "I believe we were discussing the wigwam." Here are the parts that Miss Swenson lost in the days that followed. 3 molars, the end of her nose, a chunk of one shoulder which she shook from her sleeve, her lower lip, and assorted fingers and toes, including all of the fingers of her right hand except the thumb. She still managed to hold the chalk by pinning it between thumb and palm. Her penmanship didn't look much different than usual. We applauded this triumph, literally applauded it with our shamelessly whole hands, and she acknowledged the tribute with a nod before continuing with the lesson. There was something different about her lessons now. We were attending to them anew, horrified, rapt. Miss Swenson was not a dramatically better teacher than she had been before. She still apologized and bobbled, though the missing lower lip gave her an irritated expression. But we were dramatically better students. We wondered which words would move her enough to move a piece off of her, and the wondering made us really listen to those words, which made us learn from them, in most cases, for the first time. We learned to multiply and divide large numbers gracefully, to conjugate French verbs, to spell ambiguity. We learned the order of Civil War battles and the types of rocks, igneous, metamorphic, sedimentary. This progress was so painless it was scarcely noticeable to us. In becoming a mystery, Miss Swenson had gained our devotion. Our love and our fear of her grew in direct proportion to the little sheeted mounds in her desk drawers. One day at recess, Tom Milk brought out a tissue bundle he said he had stolen from the desk. He claimed it was the left index finger we had seen her shed 2 days earlier. His reluctance to let us see it was a tell, though, and when Sean Greger seized it from him and shook it out, nothing but more tissues emerged to dance away across the pavement. You could not have paid us, any of us, to touch the genuine relics. It was a month from the first earlobe to the culmination. We had suspected some end must be nearing. What can be left, we whispered, but still we were unprepared. Miss Swenson was explaining the mating rituals of frogs. The male gives a little call like this, whoo, whoo. She sounded more like an owl. She crouched down to approximate a frog with her carriage. He tries to call as loud as he can. The female hears the call and thinks, oh my, what's that? And then she gives a little hop. This was where Miss Swenson forgot her limitations and gave a little hop of her own to demonstrate. It was a small hop, but it was enough. In addition to the thump of her weight as her feet hit the ground, there was a sound like wet cloth tearing. Both of her legs detached somewhere near the hips and fell away beneath her skirt. Her torso plummeted. Oof, she said with the impact. Her shoulders separated from her chest, her head separated from her neck, and landed face down on the carpet. There was silence. Okay, Miss Swenson said. Her voice was carpet muffled, bright with effort. That wasn't so bad, not as bad as I thought it would be. Stephanie? Stephanie was the girl at whose socks Miss Swenson was now staring. Stephanie, would you please put me on that chair? Stephanie did not want to touch the head. We could all see this, but how do you refuse a request like that? She picked Miss Swenson up, holding her far away from her own body, and carried her toward a chair at the front of the room. She had to step over Miss Swenson's torso to get there, and she looked down, seeming to consider and then dismiss the possibility that she was responsible for it, too. At least that's over, Miss Swenson said en route. When Stephanie put her down, though, we could tell it wasn't over yet. A great hunk of Miss Swenson's hair came away in Stephanie's hand. Stephanie shrieked softly and brushed it off against her pants, where it clung for a moment before falling to the floor. Miss Swenson didn't seem to notice. As we watched, one of her eyebrows lifted from her face like peeling paint and fell in a curl to the seat of the chair. Her upper lip was starting to look crooked. Children, we must be quick now, Miss Swenson said. It is time for you to show what you have learned. We misunderstood her at first. We rummaged frantically for pencils and paper. Some of us set to work multiplying and dividing. Others began to spell out previously elusive words. Still others began lists of facts. We could have filled pages and pages with those facts. We could have wallpapered the classroom with them. Not that, Miss Swenson said. We looked up at her. An eyelid slipped its moorings. Is that all you know? Is that all I've taught you? Her panic had set the eyeball beneath the crazily hung eyelid rolling. We wondered if she could still see out of it. We waited for her to regain her composure and tell us again what we were to do. We wanted to please her as much as we had ever wanted anything. You must see, she said. It's your turn, children. You'll have to, you know. And haven't I been demonstrating for weeks now? Haven't you been paying attention? All of you ought to know by now how it is done. Those of us who had understood were hoping we hadn't. Miss Swenson's patience had run out. Show me, children, she screamed. Come apart. But the force of that pee was too much. It blew her upper lip clear off. Her gaze followed it as it sailed away from her, hit the edge of Stephanie's desk, and stuck, and she seemed to surrender. We had thought the finale would be spectacular. We had been waiting for days for her eyes to pop cartoonishly, for her to fling a moist slab of tongue toward us. These things did not happen. She just gave a sigh, and her head sank to one side a little, and that was all. All except for the feelings we felt next. It began differently for each of us, Miss Swenson's final lesson. Some of us felt it gathering in the tiny bird bones of our fingers, some in our hard, pink, healthy gums. For some, it came first to the pristine joints of our vertebrae. For still others, it settled in the unobstructed tunnels, lustrous and smooth, that led into and out of our childish and unscarred hearts. But though it took so many different forms, the beginning was universal. Not even the most whole among us was exempt. You would not have seen a difference to look at us, but we had changed, were changing, as our seams learned how to loosen. We were becoming divisible. We would come to understand that in this way, Miss Swenson had prepared us. For the future is gated, and there are tolls to be paid.